He exploded at a crew member for farting. Please don't do this ridiculous stuff. It's disgusting like hell. Sandy stood there so open-mouthed that it looked as if he were waiting for someone to lob something nutritive at him. Finally, Tommy commanded me to sit off camera, hoping that my becoming his living eyeline would help him. It didn't. Everything became infectiously not funny, funny. People were turning away from the set, their faces constipated with laughter they dared not release. Tommy didn't notice any of this. He was locked into a scene in a moment he couldn't bring to life. It was as horrifyingly transfixing as watching a baby crawl across the 405 freeway. We were all waiting for a miracle. It took Tommy 30 minutes to feel comfortable enough to walk down the outhouse's two steps without staring at his feet. It took another 30 minutes for him to take those two steps while also remembering his lines. With time and effort, he got the walking, talking aspect of the performance down. But doing all this while hitting his mark and looking at me remained a grand fantasy. Sandy kept saying, "Now you need to look up when you say hi to Mark." Tommy would nod, yes, indeed, exactly what he needed to do. He would try and try again. "Tommy, Johnny, I did not. Sandy, look up. Tommy, Johnny. Oh, hi, Mark. Sandy, up, up." Sandy stopped everything and took Tommy aside. He tried to reason with him, as though Tommy's understanding and not Tommy's ability were the real problem. "You have to look at Mark when you say the line, okay? Because right now you're looking down." "Okay," Tommy said. He'd rehearsed this moment for half the day, and this was the result. Soon the cameraman was laughing so hard that his camera started to shake during takes. Sandy decided to watch some VHS playbacks to see if there was anything, anything at all, usable. I was still sitting off camera, feeling as though I'd been dosed with something potent. Tommy came over to me, looking worried. "How am I doing?" he asked. "Give me the feedback. Something." It was a genuine request. I felt sorry for him at that moment. I knew how hard he was trying. I also knew that being a dramatic actor was the most important thing to Tommy. Everything he'd done in life was to get to this point. How could I help him? I had no idea. "You're doing great," I said. But the obvious peril Tommy was in, that the whole production was now in, had broken through his vanity. For once, Tommy wanted something more than chummy assurance. "How," Tommy asked again, more insistently, "am I doing? Don't pull my legs." I looked around thinking props, because props always helped Tommy. They took his mind off trying to act. I saw a nearby water bottle and grabbed it. "Here," I said, handing the bottle to Tommy. "Use this. You know what you're supposed to do, right? So do it. What do you always tell me? Show some emotion." Tommy smiled in pure holy relief. "Why didn't you tell me emotion? My God, that's easy part. Now you see why I need you here? These other people don't care." He immediately started peeling off the water bottle sticker, because nothing scared Tommy more than having to pay someone for permission to use the logo. Tommy is probably the world's single most copyright-obsessed human being who does not also have a law degree. Sandy joined us on the side of the rooftop set. He looked for a long time at Tommy's water bottle before speaking. "What's this?" "Water bottle," Tommy said. Sandy took in a lungful of deep, calming breath. "Yes," he said. "I know. What are we doing with it?" "I need to throw something, damn it, during scene." Sandy turned away, removed his glasses, sat down, and rubbed his eyes. Tommy headed back to the outhouse, his water bottle in hand, and his script hidden in his breast pocket. I sat down. Sandy stood by the monitor. "Action!" The door flew open, and there was Tommy holding his water bottle and stepping out of the outhouse. and hitting his head on the door jamb so hard that it took 20 minutes to ice the bump and conceal it with makeup. I heard one of the cameramen say, desperately, "How are we ever going to get this? It's impossible. We'll be here forever." Then, just for comic relief, Don and Brianna arrived on set to pick up their checks. Tommy, sitting in the makeup chair while Amy iced his forehead down, ignored them at first. Brianna talked to Juliet as Don ginned up the courage to approach Tommy. Their brief, chilly exchange ended with Tommy signing two $1,500 checks. Don, I could tell, was a little relieved not to be doing the room. Really, he was surprisingly decent about the whole thing, even telling me that someday we'd be able to laugh about this. Tommy had deigned to acknowledge Don, but he wouldn't, for whatever reason, talk to or even look at Brianna. I gave Brianna her check. "Look at him," she said, holding it as though about to rip it in half. Tommy was still sitting in makeup, pressing an ice pack to his forehead. "He won't even acknowledge me. He's such a pussy." Tommy noticed me idling too long with Brianna and called me over. "Greg, I need you here." He wanted to continue running his lines. It was hopeless. He still couldn't remember them, and now, to make things worse, it was possible he had a concussion. Sandy and I huddled together and came up with a handy formula for Tommy to remember. When I returned to Tommy, I said this. "Okay, so here's what you do. I did not, mad, throw the water bottle, stop, noticed me, look up." Tommy asked that I repeat the formula several times. "Show me once more," Tommy said. By now his bruise had been buried beneath a beige snowdrift of concealer. He was, finally, ready. He took a breath, returned to the outhouse, and did the scene. At long last, we got the shot. It took 3 hours and 32 takes, but we got the shot. If you can, I implore you to watch this scene. It's 7 seconds long, 3 hours, 32 takes. And it was only the second day of filming. The next day, Tommy came to the set with some ambitious ideas for camera angles. He wanted to begin by filming the scene in which Johnny and Denny talk on the rooftop and have the camera do some fast spinning motions, or maybe do some bird's eye shots from a crane. His other demands, "Where is football? Art director, we need football. Greg, I need script. I'm missing page 49. Lighting department, we need more lights. The more lights, the better." To make things even more exciting, Tommy decided he wanted to film his and Philip's scene while tossing a football back and forth, which is a more complicated thing to stage than it sounds. Tommy, in short, was driving the crew bananas. Raphael was particularly flabbergasted and began taking long walks around the set, tapping his left foot and sometimes calling out, "Can we do a scene, please?" Tommy, meanwhile, fretted over minute details with Sandy, such as which direction a thrown football would rotate. These Tommy versus Sandy discussions occasionally became a little surreal. During Tommy's scene with Philip, Sandy suggested they get a fan to create the illusion of a windy rooftop. Tommy said that wasn't necessary because it wasn't too hot out. Sandy said, "I'm not trying to cool you down. I'm trying to make the scene feel real." Tommy laughed and said, "Are you tripping me? A fan? That's a good one." During the scene, Denny confesses to Johnny that he thinks he might be in love with Johnny's future wife, Lisa. Johnny says this is okay, because if everyone in the world loved each other, the world would be a better place. Raphael, who had never seen a full script, watched with a look of disbelief as Tommy recited these lines. Sandy's hand was plastered to his forehead, as though he were trying to keep the weirdness from penetrating his mind. While Tommy was shooting the Johnny-Denny rooftop scene, the art department was busy dismantling the indoor alley set where Denny's confrontation with Chris Hare had been filmed. They planned to begin assembly on Johnny and Lisa's living room set as soon as they were finished. When Tommy discovered what the art department was doing, he went crazy. It turned out Tommy wasn't finished with the alley set. There was another scene he wanted to shoot on it. Sandy couldn't believe this. Most productions film on a given set until they've completed that set's allotted scenes. When you change sets, you send a clear signal that you're moving on. The scene Tommy still wanted to shoot in the alley was probably the least important one in the entire script. It opens with Johnny and Mike running into each other in the alley, after which Mike explains to Johnny how he broke into Johnny's apartment to have sex, forgot his underwear, and was yelled at by Johnny's future mother-in-law. Johnny's response? That's life. The head of the art department was a woman named Merce. She eventually agreed to rebuild the alley, but only once Tommy promised to pay her for doing the same job twice. It took 22 hours to dismantle the alley set, and another 20 hours to put it back up. Once finished, Merce gave Tommy her receipts. One item leaped out at him.
$200 for nails?
Yes, Tommy, she said, evenly. That's what they cost. Tommy handed her back the receipts.
I've done construction before, my dear. I built steel buildings with my two hands. You must be kidding me.
Merce wound up having to eat most of the nail expenditure. As the alley set was being reassembled, many of the cast and crew begged Sandy to talk Tommy out of shooting the scene. Leading the call was Scott Holmes, who played Mike. Scott was saddled with having to say many of the scene's most preposterous lines. I've got to go see Michelle in a little bit to make out with her. And collapse in pain at the end of the scene for no reason. The original script says only that Mike has a sudden fall into some trash cans and hurts his leg. But the script was curiously silent as to what provokes this sudden fall. Now Tommy wanted to make the scene about, what else, football. Mark injures Mike by roughly and unexpectedly handing him the ball. This causes Mike to collapse and Johnny to suggest a visit to the hospital. How you get from an unanticipated football handoff to potential hospitalization, I have no idea. Scott and I more or less settled on how I was going to injure him with the football, but by the time we were ready to shoot the scene, Tommy was gone. He'd rushed off to work out, since he decided he'd be wearing his tank top in the scene. He returned 30 minutes later, slightly out of breath, and smelling not unlike an onion that had been stored inside a man's shoe. We shot the scene. Everything in the room is bad, but there's often an integrity about it. This alley scene has a different character. It feels like a bunch of clueless film students got together with some jerk-off improv group and decided to make 5% of a movie together. Tommy watched the footage of the scene with his headphones on. He was staring so intently at the monitor that some of us became certain that Tommy saw the scene at last as the pointless disaster it undeniably was. Sandy tried to comfort Tommy.
It's okay, he said, tapping him on the shoulder. Forget this scene. Nothing happens in it anyway. Save your money. Let's move on and film the living room stuff.
Tommy looked back at Sandy in shock.
No, he said, smiling. This is good, fun scene. We have good chemistry. And look at this.
He directed Sandy's attention to the monitor.
You see that? I look strong. Like little 18 years old kid.
That's when I realized why the scene meant so much to him. In that monitor, at least, Tommy was young and had a fun life and many, many friends.
6. Too young to die. You're the brother I never had. I'm the brother you never had. Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. Making my way to the stage in the lower basement of Gene Shelton's theater was always a little disquieting. The lights were blinding, and I was always aware of Shelton's small,
penetrating eyes on me. So you can probably imagine the degree to which my anxiety was intensified when I was about to go on stage with Tommy for the first time. Three exchanges into Tommy's and my scene, I blew a line. To fill in the resulting silence, Tommy had absolutely no hope of remembering his lines if his scene partner screwed up, I instigated a fake onstage fight, trying, I guess, to out-Tommy Tommy. I fake-kicked Tommy, he fake-collapsed, and writhed in fake pain. "Okay, you two," Sheldon said. "We can calm down now." We got up and tried to continue with the scene, but Tommy was so completely shocked, as he would later say, by my theatrics that he spent the rest of our time on stage making up new, uniquely useless lines. The class loved it. Sheldon didn't. When we were done, she yelled at us both, which was every bit the bowel-loosening experience I feared it would be. When we sat down, Tommy whispered to me, "You are completely off the wall." Which is when I had to accept the shocking truth. I had embarrassed Tommy. For the rest of the night, Tommy barely looked at me. When class let out, he demanded I buy him apology chocolates from the nearest C's merchant. "Get me the mint," he said. Still, what I appreciated about Tommy early on was how willing he was to go, no questions asked, on whatever strange crusade I was thinking about. I'd finished reading the James Dean biography I'd borrowed from Tommy and had become newly fascinated by Dean's sad, crooked journey into legend. I had the idea to take a pilgrimage south and find the exact spot of Dean's fatal car accident near the tiny town of Shalom, California. Most people would have found this a morbid, long, boring road trip. But the moment I brought it up with Tommy, he said, "Sure, why not? Sounds like adventure." We took his car. I drove. Tommy reclined his seat, covered his face and neck with a t-shirt, and promptly fell asleep. I pushed Tommy's car to 110 miles per hour, and still the man did not stir. When Tommy was out, he was out. Years later, I saw him fall asleep in the middle of a conversation. Once I even saw him fall asleep while eating. We arrived at the fateful spot on Highway 46 around sundown, the time when Dean had been killed. The moment I put Tommy's Benz in park, he sat up. Another talent of Tommy's was being able to sleep for exactly as long as a car trip took. In this respect, and this respect alone, Tommy's brain was digital. We got out of the car and stood on the side of the road. I described for Tommy how the Dean crash went down. I showed him the roadside monument that had been built in Dean's honor, which greatly impressed him. There was also a Dean-centric restaurant close by called the Jack Ranch Cafe. "Maybe," I said, "we should check it out." Outside the cafe was a sign, "Beware of rattlesnakes." Inside, it looked like an Old West diner with a 50s theme, complete with a jukebox, vintage bubblegum machine, antiquated Pepsi ads, life-size cardboard stand-ups of Dean from Rebel Without a Cause, and a big wooden wagon positioned in the middle of the dining room. Tommy and I took in all the Dean pictures and memorabilia, including an original copy of the local newspaper's account of Dean's death. In almost every photo, Dean was doing that famous squinty wince pout that a lot of young male actors go through a phase of trying to approximate. Tommy kept making small, impressed sounds as he leaned in close to read the photo's captions. I'd never seen Tommy so rapt before, so respectful, so silent. Even when we sat down, Tommy continued to look around. "You have resemblance to him," Tommy said suddenly. "But your face is in, his is more out." "What?" I said, wondering where he was going with this. "My God, you are behind the schedule. Listen to me, young man. I'm sorry, but you need more than resemblance. Dean has this signature thing.
Yeah, I said, it's called being James Dean. Tommy didn't respond to this. So tell me, what do you like so much about James Dean? Tommy's hands moved around excitedly.
Look, he's very, you know, moment to moment. He's emotion, real emotion, not plastic, from the heart. Words are secondary. The way he speaks, style, and that's what you need. Don't be jealous. You can do it.
He was back in elder thespian mode, bullshitting about the craft. It was funny, nevertheless.
Greg, he went on, I keep telling you, you need to watch the James Dean. Watch him. Very close, you watch him and you'll learn.
Also, before I forget, I want my James Dean book back for your information.
We headed back to San Francisco. Having just spent so much time thinking about Dean and cars and dying, this time I didn't speed. Tommy, as though reading my mind, asked that I take it easy around any curves. Then he added, I have my own James Dean story, you know. A long time ago, he said, when he was just a kid in France, he'd been in a car accident. It happened during a joyride with a friend who did tricky stuff. With Tommy and his friend were two girls they'd picked up. Tommy's friend was showing off for the girls by taking turns on a perilously twisty road far too fast. Eventually, he missed one of these turns. The car flipped over four times, punched through the guardrail, and plunged into a lake upside down. The girls were screaming as the car filled up with water and began to sink. Tommy kept shouting at them to shut up as he tried to get the door open. He couldn't. Tommy told me that he saw a big light, and his entire life flashed before his eyes. The only thought in his mind as the water reached his chin was, God, please help us. I'm too young to die. Then the water stopped rising. Tommy was able to force the doors open. All four escaped and swam to the shore. Tommy described coughing up water on the shoreline and watching as the car's headlights disappeared into the dark water below.
It was like Titanic, he said. I couldn't believe I survived.
It was the first time Tommy had ever opened up to me. While I doubted some of his story's particulars, to say the least, it was obviously a life-changing incident for him, and he believed his version of events.
After the accident, he said, I was sick for 2 weeks. I have bad dreams for a long time. I never have been so scared in my life.
He told me that not even his second big car accident, which also had almost killed him, had been as terrifying. I remained silent for a little while, thinking of a way to tell Tommy how glad I was he'd told me this story. But then I looked over at him and he was asleep. I watched the mileage signs drift by and thought about what Tommy had shared. I hadn't known him long, but in that short time I'd learned to detect when he was telling the truth. Something, I think, changed between us when he told me that story. Tommy had removed one small piece of his armor and placed it trustingly before me. Before I met Tommy, I would not have day-tripped to the spot where James Dean died. There would have been too many critical voices in my head telling me how dumb and pointless such a trip would be. Tommy, though, made me realize I could drive to James Dean's crash site for the simple reason that I felt like doing it. He made me realize that doing such things was the whole point of being young. This was not an attitude that came easily to me, but I could say or do anything around Tommy, and he wouldn't judge me. How could he? He was the weirdest person I'd ever met, but lovably weird. Around Tommy, I could be who I wanted to be, and to me, that felt like freedom. When we got closer to San Francisco, I cranked up some music to keep myself awake. The only CDs Tommy had in the car were Van Halen and Richard Marx. So, Van Halen it was. When the song Dreams came on, Tommy woke up and sang along for a couple choruses, getting 90% of the words wrong. He sang with such deranged feeling, though, that I knew he would have been the toast of any karaoke bar worth its salt. When the song was over, Tommy noticed how late it was, which was when I realized that I'd missed our exit and gotten us lost.
"You see," Tommy said, "you act like crazy man first in class and now on highway. It's midnight and you are lost like hell. But that's okay. Don't need to have panicky situation. No restrictions. Be yourself."
I took the next exit I saw and only succeeded in getting us more lost. Tommy, meanwhile, pulled out his cell phone and called someone. I heard a woman's voice on the other end. Their conversation was nothing but small talk, but who makes small talk after midnight? When Tommy told the woman he'd spent the day in Santa Barbara, I couldn't decide if he was lying or simply confused. When Tommy hung up, I asked him to whom he'd been speaking. He looked over at me.
"None of your information," he said.
"Come on," I said. "Was that your girlfriend?" It hadn't been a young voice on the phone. It sounded thin and trembly, more like an older woman. Tommy laughed out loud.
"No, not girlfriend."
"Who then? Your aunt?"
"Chloe is her name. Maybe she's my girlfriend, maybe not. You might meet her, but not at this time."
By now, we were lost enough to need a search party. Tommy pointed out a desolate truck stop and demanded we pull over and get directions. What he really wanted was a chance to buy himself several boxes of Cracker Jack. Tommy, I realized, didn't care if we were lost. It wasn't his bedtime for many hours yet, and driving around rural California was a lot more interesting than being cooped up in his condo. Thanks to a road map inside the truck stop, I was able to figure out where we were. Back in the car, Tommy animatedly pulled the prize out of every one of his Cracker Jack boxes, but the only one he liked was a little toy figurine he seemed to think was Pinocchio. I forged on back home. As we were driving, something caught Tommy's attention outside the window. He pointed.
"You see that? My God! Monster!"
"Yeah," I said. "That was a deer."
"Tear my foot! That thing will kill you. You don't know why or how."
"Speaking of killer, when I sleep, I have dreamed that you tried to kill me."
How is it that you begin to get less tired at 1 in the morning?
"Can I teach you something? Don't say the word tired, or you will become more tired. Also, please be careful how you drive. I don't want to die. I have many dreams in my life. I want to make a lot of movies like Hitchcock. Maybe live 200 more years, too."
At the time, any one of those things sounded roughly as plausible as the other.
"And what about you, young man? What is your dream, other than finding Map? Is it that you want to be James Dean? Class is over next week, you know that, don't you?
School is over, as they say."
Tommy was right. Even worse, I hadn't made any post-class plans. All I knew was that I didn't want to take more acting classes anytime soon. So what did I want to do? I told Tommy the first thing that popped into my head. "I want to go to LA.
"Really?" Tommy said, impressed now, sitting up. "Okay. So why don't you stay in my place?"
"Your place?"
"In LA. I have an apartment there."
"You have an apartment in LA?"
"Yeah. I charge you $200 a month, and you can use it if you want."
I've always believed that all dots connect eventually, that all experiences serve a distinct purpose. When I didn't get the role in Wildflowers, I tried, unconvincingly, to tell myself that there was good reason.
that something positive would eventually come from it. Then I became scene partners with Tommy, and he brought up his hitherto unmentioned LA apartment. It was the opportunity I'd been waiting for. "When is the apartment available?" I said, trying to seem only vaguely interested. Tommy shrugged and smiled, seeing right through me.
"Don't play the politics, young man. So look, I have to go to LA next week after class. You can check out apartment. We go to LA together and you can decide. It's up to you. I don't force you."
I trusted Tommy. He was secretive and moody, but also giving and supportive. From watching Tommy and Gene Shelton's class, I got the sense that he'd been judged his whole life. When it came to friendship, at least, I suspected that almost no one had given Tommy a chance. I was willing to take that leap of faith. What I wasn't admitting to myself, what I probably couldn't admit to myself back then, was that I met Tommy in the midst of the most aggressively, desperately lonesome months of my life. I needed a friend as much as he did. Maybe even more. My mother wasn't going to like the sound of me checking out an apartment in LA. The worst thing I could imagine was Tommy and my mother discussing my future together. I couldn't give her a chance to talk me out of this or forbid it. If I was going to pursue my dream, I had to take this chance. It was the only way. "LA after class?" I said to Tommy, as though I hadn't just torn my mind to shreds thinking the matter over.
"Yeah," Tommy said. "Next week. We go if you want."
"Okay," I said. "That sounds good." Tommy's and my final scene in Gene Shelton's class was a pillow fight. This was a Shelton-devised exercise to keep Tommy and me from stepping on each other's lines. After I said my line, I would gently hit Tommy with my pillow. After Tommy said his line, he would hit me with his pillow 3 times. Shelton started laughing the first time Tommy did this, which only made him whack me more furiously. That was how our last class ended. I told a few people about my upcoming trip to Los Angeles with Tommy, including an old unicycle-riding hippie friend of mine who worked for Lucasfilm as an editor. My hippie friend did not like Tommy. He'd sat in on one of Gene Shelton's classes once and thought Tommy was almost certainly an addict of some kind. The word he used to describe him was ravaged. Based on what I'd seen, at least, the most dangerous thing Tommy put in his body was piping hot water. My friend also thought it was incredibly odd that Tommy would offer me his mysteriously vacant LA apartment at such a cheap price without wanting anything from me in return. "There's a catch to this," he told me. "Please be careful." None of these were unreasonable observations, and had I not spent a good amount of time around Tommy, I probably would have thought the whole situation was insane, too. I called Tommy the night before we were supposed to head to LA to see what time he wanted to leave. Instead of hearing his usual outgoing message, I heard this.
"Hi, babyface. I'm not around until 10 p.m., but I called you later."
Babyface derived from something Tommy had said on the fly in class a few weeks ago, when comparing my face to his during a rant about what type we were acting-wise.
"I have potato face. Your face is delicate, like a baby face."
He'd never used it as a nickname, though. I hoped this would be the first and last time. I told my mother I was going to Los Angeles with Tommy. She'd managed to hold her tongue until the morning of our departure.
"You're crazy to be doing this," she said over and over.
I countered that she had to trust me, just this once, and let me find my way. She heard me out, but wasn't convinced.
"It's just crazy," she said. "You realize this, mon cher, yes? That you're crazy? I hope this trip is not your end."
"My end? My end," I wanted to tell her, "my real end, would be never trying anything, not taking any risks, and working a job I had zero passion for. I reassured her that I'd be back in less than 36 hours. I hadn't decided if I was moving to LA or not. I'd call her every hour if she wanted me to. She drove me to the Walnut Creek BART station where Tommy was picking me up. He was, of course, late, and as the time piled up, one swollen gray minute atop the other, my mother sat there and detailed the many ways in which my one day in Los Angeles was going to wreck my life forever. I have never been so relieved to see Tommy as when his Benz finally floated into that parking lot. My mother followed me to Tommy's car like a shadow. I started to say something to her, but she looked at me with such intensity that I knew I couldn't stop her. I owed her the courtesy of letting her speak to Tommy directly. Tommy obviously wasn't expecting my mother to be waiting with me, and he powered down his window with the queasy, smiling nervousness of an inveterate speeder welcoming the arrival of a California State Trooper. He kept looking at me, but I couldn't save him. He was going to have to endure this. My mother didn't bother reintroducing herself. "Are you going to LA, Tommy?" she asked him. When my mother said Tommy, it sounded like Tom E, with a rise at the end so sharp you could jump a bike off of it.
"Yes," Tommy said, I am. We are going.
He was, unpromisingly, stuttering from sheer nervousness. My mother nodded.
"Perhaps you can wait to go until next week so I can join you."
"No, I'm sorry. I have to go now. I have a meeting there. People waiting for me."
She didn't even bother pretending to believe him.
"Tommy, I'm a little bit concerned because I'm looking at your eyes and they are completely red. It's obvious you haven't slept."
"Well, I don't know what to say about that."
"You are going to drive like this?"
"I'm okay."
He put his arms up, smiling. He knew better than to tell my mother that I drove his car. My mother stared at him with prosecutorial eyes.
"Tommy, how old are you?"
"I'm 28.
She didn't believe this, either. No one on planet Earth would have believed this.
"Is that so, Tommy? Maybe then you can tell me why you want to help my son."
"I think he's a cool guy."
"Well, that's very interesting, because I'm very concerned, Tommy. Where are you going to stay in LA?"
"I have my place. It's fine. We go for one day."
"Is it safe, Tommy? I just don't feel good about this."
"Mom," I said. "Mom, come on." My mother looked at me. She breathed very deeply, as though letting go of something, which was, I guess, me. Then she looked back at Tommy.
"Be careful, Tommy, please."
"I will."
"Tommy, don't hurt my son."
I put my hand over my eyes. The worst thing Tommy could do in response to this request, I thought, would be to chuckle creepily.
"I would not," Tommy said, chuckling creepily.
"And one more thing, Tommy. One more thing.
No sex, Tommy, okay? Are we clear?"
"Mom!"
"Well, we all do."
My mother looked at him coldly for a moment. Then she took a step toward him.
"What was that, Tommy?"
Tommy shrugged, beginning to panic.
"You know, we all do."
"I'm afraid I don't know what this means, but I think you understand me now."
Translation: if you touch my son, I will kill you. She walked away without saying goodbye. It took me a long, painful moment to accept that my mother had just asked another man not to have sex with me. I got into Tommy's car, emotionally concussed. Once my mother was gone, he whirled on me.
"What the heck was that? She's crazy. Your mother is off the wall. Crazy, my God. No sex. What a story."
My mother was right about one thing. Tommy really hadn't slept all night. He started nodding off at the wheel as he drove away, so he pulled over and we switched seats. Tommy put a white t-shirt over his head and neck, tilted the seat back as far as it could go, and was bombed out and snoring by the time we hit the highway. It was August 31st, 1998. I'd known Tommy Wiseau less than a month. Tommy finally woke up at the moment we hit the Sunset Boulevard exit on the 405. "How do you always do that?" I asked him.
"Do what?"
"Know exactly when to wake up."
"Vampire trick," Tommy said.
Sometimes it really did seem as though Tommy wanted to be a vampire. Maybe being a vampire formed for Tommy a bridge between being objectively unattractive and subjectively attractive. The last thing Tommy Wiseau wanted to be was average. He had that in common with most people, of course. But Tommy took it several steps further. He took everything several steps further. As we drove down Sunset Boulevard, Tommy described to me the vampire movie he wanted to make. It had, I must admit, a killer title. The Vampire from Alcatraz, King of Vampires. Before we headed to Tommy's apartment, though, he announced that he was hungry. I knew exactly where to go. James Dean's favorite restaurant in Hollywood was an Italian place called the Villa Capri, where, according to legend, Sir Alec Guinness had warned Dean a week before his death that if he insisted on driving his speedy new Porsche Spider, he'd be dead in a week. At Villa Capri, Dean had become close with a young waiter named Mario Marino. In the acknowledgments of his James Dean biography, Joe Hyams thanks Marino, who now owned his own restaurant in Hollywood called Marino. I relayed all this information to Tommy and said, "Let's go have dinner and meet a guy who knew James Dean."
"Babyface's ideas," Tommy said approvingly, "are crazy. They never stop."
I was unexpectedly nervous inside the restaurant. Was I really going to get to meet a man who knew, who had spoken intimately to James Dean? Halfway into our meal, I couldn't hold back my curiosity any longer. I walked up to the hostess and asked her if Mario Marino was in tonight. He wasn't. I returned to our table sorely disappointed.
"My God," Tommy said, "you're obsessed. This is obsession. You will meet him, don't worry."
"Thanks, Tommy."
"You know," Tommy said, forking away at his pesto, "I shot my Super 8 movie near here."
"The one you showed me? Starring Bigfoot?"
"Not Bigfoot, you must be kidding. Robbery doesn't pay, I show you, remember?"
"Of course, how could I forget?"
"So we shoot few blocks from here in Westwood. I live there too. My roommate had like a huge snake. I was so scared of it I had to move out. I thought maybe it would kill me. Then I get my own place on the Crescent Heights, which you will see tonight."
Tommy stopped eating for a moment.
"I don't know. Maybe it's not good for you. Maybe you don't like it. We see."
"Okay," I said, getting a little anxious. These were a lot of caveats. Tommy noticed my unease.
"Don't worry," he said. "I think you will like the place. It's not Castle, though."
"Okay." That didn't make me feel much better. Tommy looked at me.
"I used to live in such small apartment with my family, you know, when I was a little kid."
His voice lowered, as though drawing back into his memory to reclaim something truthful.
"I even have to share bed sometimes with my entire family. When my little cousin fell asleep, sometimes he tore my hair with his finger."
He quickly warded that memory away.
"But let me tell you," Tommy said, "coming to LA is not easy, my friend. But you know, you take your time, you grow up. You are just 16 now."
"Actually," I said, "I'm 20. I told Tommy my age several times. For some reason, Tommy always lowered it. Much like I assumed, he lowered his. Oh, Tommy said, pausing. Well, whatever. But you are just a kid now, and you become independent. So you have my support. You know, when I start my business, I make 25 cents an hour.
What business? Street fashions? Tommy looked around.
Don't say so loud. Yes, 25 cents an hour.
He had to be lying. Who other than third world laborers made 25 cents an hour?
Suddenly, Kirk Douglas walked into the restaurant. Spartacus himself. I pointed Douglas out to Tommy, but Tommy thought I was indicating one of Marino's heavyset waiters. When I finally got Tommy to look directly at Douglas, Tommy returned to his food and said, Big star, who cares? Tommy wasn't interested in giving the power of stardom to somebody else. So, he said, I tell you another secret, maybe. You know how I start my business? Nah, maybe that story wait. Maybe you're not ready for it. But the fact is I've many jobs in my life. So many, you can write book about them all.
Yeah? Like what?
In many other places, France, Louisiana, etc. I'm pretty good in the business, but not so good with the love. Girls can be very tricky, but that's life. You know the expression? 10 seconds pleasure, 10 years hatred. I suspected that Tommy had probably had a normal life at one point. Then, I presumed, some kind of personal calamity, nervous breakdown, midlife crisis, heartbreak, addiction, something, caused him to grow his hair long and go into hibernation, only to come out broken and different. I was catching Tommy as he emerged from that reclusion, and the thing powering his emergence was his reignited desire to become an actor. I was curious to learn as much about Tommy as I could. I felt like I was seeing a case study of what happens to someone whose dreams had been stifled. I was reaching out to Tommy, and he was reaching out to me, but for entirely different reasons. Both of us were stuck. Neither of us knew what to do next. If either of us bailed on the other now, I thought, we'd both sink. Mario Marino entered the restaurant. The waitress walked over to point him out to me. Could we meet him? I asked. Sure, she said, and went to fetch him. I told Tommy we were about to meet the man who knew James Dean, and suddenly there Mario was, standing beside our table, looking incredibly youthful and vigorously black-haired for being almost 70 years old. Buena sera, he said. I shook Mario's hand and told him I had read about him in Joe Hyam's James Dean biography. James Dean! Mario less said than exploded in the Italian way. You half expected there to be confetti floating around the ends of his sentences. Yes, yes, very nice young man. He loved pasta, a lot of pasta. I asked what Dean was like, his favorite dishes, whether the Villa Capri was still open, everything. In retrospect, it was a little embarrassing. But Mario answered patiently. He had perfected the restaurateur's gift of pretending you were adored and welcome, even if you were being a total dork. At which point, Tommy got involved. What do you really think of James Dean overall? Tommy asked Mario. Oh, a very nice boy. Very nice. He's not overrated a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Come on, give us something. What crazy things he do? Don't be phony. You can be honest. I won't say anything. No, no, Mario said, eyeing Tommy suspiciously. His voice deepened and firmed up. Very nice. Very nice guy. And with that, Mario gracefully excused himself. We were back in Tommy's car now, and he pulled out a piece of paper. This, he said, is code to parking garage. I don't know if he changed from last year. Last year? When was the last time Tommy was here?
He then informed me that he told the building manager he was showing the apartment to his little cousin. So if I saw her, I had to pretend to be Tommy's cousin. We were driving down Fountain, headed toward Crescent Heights. Tommy told me to take a left, no wait, a right, then a left. Soon enough, we were lost. Tommy could not find his own apartment. We found the place, eventually. It was right down the street from the Lemley Sunset 5, where years later, the room would play regularly. We neared the apartment complex, and I saw the palm trees, and the swept sidewalks, and the handsome security gate, and caught myself thinking, this is actually a good start. Only then did I realize how dire my expectations had grown over the course of this very long day. Tommy said he would recite to me the security code he'd written down earlier. While he recited the numbers, I was supposed to type them in. The security code was this. 1, 2, 3, 4. I asked Tommy why he bothered writing that down. Tommy responded that he wrote it down because he could never remember it. This is a really cool place, I said when we got out of the car. And you're a block from Sunset. Why don't you use it more often? Tommy shrugged. I have a very busy schedule in San Francisco. I come here when I have some business. I could tell he was enjoying my surprise at how nice the building was. The apartment was on the third floor, but we had to check Tommy's mailbox before going up. When he opened the tiny metal door, two or three envelopes popped out as if spring-loaded. The rest of his mail had been crammed into the slot so tightly, it didn't look like anything less than a crowbar would be able to extricate it all. When Tommy saw the look on my face, he just laughed. Ha! It's not easy to manage life in two different cities, he said. On the elevator ride up to the third floor, Tommy told me, I pay for the place already, so it's fine for you. Rent is $900 a month, but I pay ahead so I don't have to worry about it. I pay 6 months, 4 months in advance. No stress that way. I don't like the stress. The elevator doors opened and I was hit by crisp, summery air. The corridor overlooked the complex's turquoise swimming pool, surrounded by deck chairs and glass-topped tables. Tucked between several dramatically lit palm trees was a jacuzzi. I could hear its soft nighttime burbles. At the apartment door, Tommy handed me his armful of mail while he cycled through the keys on his one key ring to rule them all. On his fourth try, the right key slid home, and we stepped inside. One bedroom. Balcony. The kitchen was large for one person, as was the living area. But for the dust, everything seemed clean and operable. Pinned to the entryway bulletin board was a single card. Sports Connection, a West Hollywood gym. Tommy strode ahead of me to turn on the air conditioner. Little by little, though, I noticed a few odd things. For instance, knee-high stacks of old Hollywood Reporters were spread around the living room, their covers advertising 5-year-old production deals and cancellation notices for television shows I'd forgotten existed. Tommy had that famous Jim Morrison American Poet poster unevenly taped, all by itself, on the left-hand wall. It also took me a few moments to notice the apartment's striking lack of furniture. Unless the Hollywood Reporters were the furniture. There was a bed in the bedroom and a glass desk in the living room, but no kitchen table, no couch, and no chairs. A boxy and ancient antennae television set sat on two Roman-style pillars. There weren't any plates or glasses in the cupboards or any silverware in the drawers. In the bathroom, I found hundreds, if not thousands, of tiny black spatter stains, almost certainly the result of numerous black hair dyeing sessions. If it weren't for the dye stains,
It would have been hard to believe that anyone, much less Tommy, had ever lived there. The apartment had so little personality that it could have been the complex's model apartment, or some love nest kept by transient adulterers. Or maybe it looked like exactly what it was. The rarely visited apartment of a strange and lonely man.
"So what do you think?" Tommy asked me.
I was already plotting out my life here.
"I think it's nice. I'll take it, if that's still okay with you."
"You don't have to rush. Take your time. See if you are comfortable."
Tommy busied himself with his mail for a bit. It was getting late now, and I was exhausted from driving all day. I set up camp using a rolled-out sheet on the living room floor and a few Hollywood reporters as pillows. Tommy was still carefully opening, reading, and throwing away his mountain of mail. I was almost asleep when I heard Tommy step around me and close his bedroom door. The shower spat to life a moment later, and he began belting out Aladdin's "A Whole New World." I listened to the thrum of the air conditioner, the whooshing of passing traffic outside, and thought about how easily I could get used to this space. It felt right. I could live here. And it was so central. But I still didn't know how Tommy managed to afford life in two different cities, as he put it. What did he really do? I was moving past the last drowsy checkpoint before sleep when Tommy's bedroom door opened. I didn't open my eyes at first, but I could sense Tommy watching me from his door jamb. I squinted my eyes open. Tommy was in a tank top and sweatpants. His toothbrush was in his mouth. His hair was wet.
"Hey," he said. "Yo, are you comfortable? Do you need anything? Sleeping process?"
I blinked at him.
"What? Are you fine?"
"Yeah," I said. I was falling asleep. I put my arm over my eyes to block the light. Tommy lingered there a moment longer. At last he started to close the bedroom door, but stopped before it clicked shut. Then I heard the bed springs accepting Tommy's weight and the dry, papery sound of sheets being pulled, pillows rearranged. Churning, restless silence followed that. A strange silence. As I began drifting back into sleep, I thought I heard Tommy say in a high, sing-song pitch, "Somebody's chicken." Somebody's chicken. I just pretend I never heard it. It was probably just Tommy being Tommy, right? It didn't matter. Moments later, I could hear Tommy snoring.
7. Where's my fucking money? Shut up, I'm rich. Norma Desmond, Sunset Boulevard. The first time Tommy gave Sandy a check, Sandy was certain it would bounce. Sandy was so sure of this that he made a wooden nickel joke with the teller at Tommy's bank. The teller, though, told Sandy not to worry.
"What do you mean?" Sandy asked.
"This account," the teller said, "it's a bottomless pit." Sandy was dumbfounded. How much money would move a teller to inappropriately confess something like that? Whoever Tommy was, Sandy now decided, he was obviously backed by someone or something big. This was very much the impression Tommy wanted everyone to have. As he said to me one morning on the way to the set, "We are shooting now for 2 weeks. You know what that means? People in Hollywood know we are fully loaded." As usual, I let Tommy hear himself, which was all he wanted to do anyway.
"Have you ever seen $1 million in cash?"
Tommy suddenly asked me.
"I have not," I said.
What I have, young man, and it looks really nice, like this.
He did a gesture.